So, welcome to week four in our series, Can I Make Room for Other, looking at narcissism and the trend of narcissistic behavior. I want to tell you, not all is bad. There's a lot of good stuff around, and there's a lot of hope. Why do I say that? Well, we're going to talk about that a bit later today, but I was very heartened last night. I did a group. We have, at Bina, we have a thing called Kayemet, which is our groups for young adults. And last night I did a beautiful group in Maroubra. It was a topic of relationships, actually, but it was not about narcissism. But it came up, and without prompting, it's not the first time I've seen this, where it's going to take time, but the young adults actually are starting to see that the society's culture is going in the wrong direction. And starting to see how it's becoming very self-absorbed and self-centered, and realizing that it's not healthy. It's not healthy for relationships, not healthy for well-being. I think that's great. That's a piece of good news. So we need to keep working on it and keep talking and keep sharing and keep inspiring ourselves and others. So just a little bit of review, first of all. Last week we were talking about the two researchers that we've been using, Keith Campbell and Jean Twenge, that how they tracked narcissism all the way from the 1960s. They talk about the 1960s not being such a bad time, a bit alternative, a bit of time of self-exploration, but not so bad in its own right. The problem was later when self-exploration transitioned to self-expression. We don't have to do anything, you just have to be yourself and express yourself. And that's where all the problems started. And we talked about it from a Jewish perspective, this idea of freeing yourself from a prison of other people, of oppressive forces, of toxic emotions coming from the outside, but then not replacing it with purpose and meaning. And what happens is you transition, we did this at length last week, you transition from the prison of other people to the prison of yourself, and that's very dangerous. And a lot of it has to do with lack of empathy, and we started to talk about empathy, and we talked about the difference between kindness and empathy. Kindness is amazing, kindness is critical, kindness is very important, but it doesn't always show that it means a person who's not self-centered or narcissistic even, because kindness can be done for the wrong motivation. It's always good to give, don't get me wrong. It's always good to help, always good to do. The action of kindness is always a good thing, but it's more empathy that makes us go out of ourselves and be in the shoes of another and so on. We'll talk about that a bit more today as well. So, this week and next, which is the two last weeks of the series, I just actually want to pause and just, so we have today and next week, which is the end of the series, but then in 2 weeks' time, we're still going to have a session, the last session of the term, and I've called it, I'm going to send it out, but I've called it, we are all teachers, or all leaders, and I want to draw some inspiration. That day is actually the 29th Yahrzeit of my mentor, the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and I thought we used to be special to end of the term. It's also my birthday around that time, so I thought we'd, you know, my Hebrew birthday. And
what date?
No, I'm not going to tell you the date. That's classified information, what do you mean?
I think 59 or 60 this year.
59. Good mathematics there. So that's a Shelley straight question, there you are. I'm kidding, I don't care. I'm not one of these people that... No, my birthday's on the 6th of Tammuz. I'm only mentioning because a Hebrew birthday is a very important thing, actually. And anyway, so we can do maybe a little bit of a morning tea, end of the term, and also because that's the day, that's the Yahrzeit of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, I'll draw some inspirations, what I heard from him or what I experienced and witnessed in terms of how he inspired other people, not just to grow, but also to be leaders. And I think that's a really important thing. Okay. So that's in 2 weeks' time, but I'll send it around. So this week and next, I want to look at... So what can we do about this? What can we do about the trend? In other words, what should we do? Now, as I said in the very beginning, when we ask the question, what can we do? Sometimes that's an overwhelming question. What are we going to do? If I do a little bit, am I going to fight the whole society? Am I going to change the culture of the world? That's the conscious or subconscious question that we ask ourselves. And it's the wrong question to ask because, as I said in the very beginning, we have a principle in Jewish thinking, a little bit of light pushes away a lot of darkness, and you never know the effect that you have. I just want to share with you a little story that I heard yesterday on a website. you know, in America, it's coming the summer now, so everyone goes to summer camps, and summer camps is a huge culture there, a huge big thing. So, overnight camps. So, in a particular camp, there was the head counselor, and he had all these counselors, his madrichim, he had them all the day before, and he was prepping them. Okay. And he said, tomorrow, all the kids are arriving, and what's going to happen is they will all get off the bus, and you'll see, this is what the head counselor told the counselors, you'll see that they're all walking in groups. They have their social cliques, right? But you will notice one child, he didn't even know who it is, he's just assuming that's going to happen because it happens every year. Yeah. One child or two children who will be walking alone without a connection to a group. Go over to that child, take him to the canteen and buy him a Danish. That's what he told me. Make that kid feel good. It was a boys' camp. So the next day, sure enough, kids walk off the bus, exactly what happened, that little group, they're excited, they're screaming, they're laughing, it's all exciting, and one counselor notices one kid walking alone. So he remembers what the head counselor said the day before, so he decided to follow the instruction. Went over to the kid, how are you, welcome to camp, can I take you to the canteen, buy something, and he sat down with him for a few minutes, and welcomed him, made him feel good, and it was like an amazing thing. So he went to the head counselor and he said, you know, what you said yesterday was actually phenomenal. It actually really worked. And I could see like the change, almost the surprise of the child that felt welcomed. And he's obviously a very lonely child. You know, one of these, you always have these kids, unfortunately, who are isolated. I'm just interested, what made you think of that instruction? So he said, because when I was a boy, I was that kid. Right? And some counselor came over to me, some person came over to me and did exactly the same thing. She says, wow, it's interesting. Who's that person? You know, I mean, it was like a community camper. She says, yeah, his name is Mr. Meisman or something. I forgot this. So this madrich, this counselor who did this now, he was very intrigued by the whole thing. And he decided he's going to track down the Mr. Meisman. So he tracks him down. He's very much older by now. And he said, I just wanted to tell you the story that, you know, you did this to a boy. That boy became the head counselor. And now he did it to us and I did it to this boy. So what made you do it, Mr. Meisman? What made you do it? He said, I did it because I was that boy. And when I was in camp, there was a rabbi who now is quite famous. Actually, his name is Reb Shmuel Kamenetsky. And his father was like a teacher in camp. And he came over, he came to visit camp. And he was walking around, he came to visit his father actually. And he was walking around camp and he noticed me. I was the lonely one. And he did exactly that. I'm just sharing with you that you never know, like, he would never know, the rabbi would never know, he probably did it a few times, you never know how many people as a result did it to other people, and because of that, other people did it to other people, right? So it has a ripple effect. What we do, I mean, I once read, there's some research study when you smile in a place, like you make six people smile, then they smile, and make six, you know, things ripple, so we should never ever think like, you know, so if I do a little thing, okay, so if I become less self-absorbed, or I do more kindness, or I show more empathy, it has, first of all, a mitzvah is always a good thing, so you never know spiritually what it can do. But even not spiritually, I'm talking about just practically, one person at a time, one act at a time, we create a culture. Okay. So, we have a principle that we mentioned many times, also written in Hebrew, it's brought down in many places, yediata makacha tzirufa, which means diagnosis is half the cure. So, it's important to know what are the symptoms, and we've talked about it a bit in the last few weeks, what are the symptoms of narcissistic behavior? Not just the root cause of self-absorption and self-centeredness, but what are the symptoms, right? Because the symptoms are important. Now, here's an interesting thing. Sometimes it's really good to know what the root cause is of something, but also sometimes also really good to know what the symptoms are. And the reason is this. Because physical health is a little bit different to emotional and spiritual health. In physical health, symptoms are not good enough. You can treat symptoms, but you never ever make progress unless you go to the cause, right? So you can have a series of headaches, you can have pains, whatever the case is, but the pain is coming from something. Yes, so you can take a Panadol, you can take a Nurofen, and it will go away, but if it recurs, you never treat the actual disease. Then it's superficial and it's really not effective. And treating the symptoms won't cure the cause. That's how it works in physical health, right? In emotional health and spiritual health, it doesn't actually work like that. Because we have this principle we've said thousands of times, that a person's heart follows their actions, the power of action. So sometimes when you just change symptoms, even if you're not there yet, even if you're not feeling that way. In other words, if you do an act of kindness to someone else, you become kinder, right? Now, even though you haven't actually treated your lack of kindness as a cause, as a disease, as an emotional problem, but you're not feeling very kind at all. You just decided you want to work on something, so you decided to do an action of kind, even though you don't particularly feel kind towards that person, you're not interested in, but you do it because it's the right thing to do in the metaphysical realm of emotion and spirituality and so on. Doing an action, treating a symptom, acting differently symptomatically actually has an effect on the actual cause. So before we talk about things that we could do, let's just review and summarize and just add a few. They do this in their book. They talk about the list of symptoms that come about when people act in a narcissistic way or are narcissistic or have some narcissistic tendencies. So the one we talked about a lot last week, of course, is the lack of empathy. That's clear. The lack of empathy is huge. I mean, in the extreme, we gave examples of people who were criminals and murderers and had no ounce, sliver of feeling for the victims, all about them, right? The second one they talk about is vanity, the overemphasis of our own expression, our own appearance, the appearance of our environment. There's nothing wrong with all that, right? It's about the extreme of it, right? Obviously, people want to live in a comfortable environment. The Talmud says, dirana'a, like a nice environment broadens the mind and makes a person be able to serve God better and so on. But it's about what's the purpose and what's the goal? Is it about to impress the whole world or is it about just being comfortable? Is it about having convenience or is it about just obsessive hedonism, essentially, right? Indulgence. You know, the Talmud says this line, beautiful line, that someone who has 100 wants 200, someone who has 200 wants 400. It's an innate impulse of a person. We always want more. Greed is a problem, right? So that's fed tremendously by narcissism as well. The other symptom we talked about briefly, but just summarizing, is the concept of being special. You know, always having to be special, having to be the center, having to be unique, having to be better, and all that kind of stuff. The other one is just antisocial behavior, like real antisocial behavior, selfishness, which, unfortunately, when it becomes stronger, it becomes abusive and immoral often, right? So infidelity, domestic violence, all these things are extreme versions of being completely selfish and being completely into oneself because it's just about the person themselves, right? And then there's, on a lesser level, general relationship problem. We talked about that last week. Another very big symptom of narcissistic behavior, which is very prevalent today, is one simple word called entitlement. There's a huge culture of entitlement today, which is a problem. And then, of course, finally, there's that lack of meaning, lack of purpose, lack of religion, lack of spirituality, and so on. Okay. So, again, for the rest of today and next week, we'll talk about some of the things that we can actually maybe do about it, where we can make sure that we are not like that in any way or inspire others. So I want to go back to what we started doing at the end of last week and just talk about empathy for a few moments. So empathy is about feeling the other, making room for the other, understanding the other's emotional crisis or pain or experience. It's really putting yourselves in the shoes of another person, noticing the other. But essentially, I think it boils down to three things which I want to talk about a little bit. And that is, number one, making room for another person. It's just that simple thing about making room for another human being in our own mind, in our own psyche, in our own intellect, in our own emotions, right? It's also about being sensitive to another. And there's also a third thing, which is an improved version of empathy in a way. Something which is hard to do sometimes is about celebrating the other. Actually being happy and celebrating the success of another human being. Right? Not just not being threatened, but it's actually about celebrating it. And we'll come to start quite an amazing thing in a few moments. So, how does this all work? How do we cultivate this, right? So in their book, Keith Campbell and Gene Twenge, they talk about simple things. First of all, about practicing humility. They talk about this concept of humility, which they say the researchers on narcissistic behavior talk about a lot. Now, we've talked about humility a lot. Of course, humility, as they say, humility is not the same as humiliation. It's a nice way to put it. It's actually right. It's a strength. And part of that strength is not to be insecure, to make room for another person, but also to be honest with ourselves, accurately honest with ourselves. Part of humility is not to overinflate ourselves. Overinflation of self leads to self-expression, negative self-expression, and narcissism, right? So it's about being honest with ourselves. We all have successes, we all have strengths, we all have weaknesses. That concept, and by the way, being honest with yourself does not only mean to highlight our weaknesses, as we've talked about many times. Being honest with ourselves means to highlight, just to be honest. Not an easy thing to do, but it's about being honest, being self-aware. You see, the more self-absorbed someone becomes, the less self-aware they become, right? That's just what happens. And, you know, sometimes you look around, you see extreme versions of lack of self-awareness, which is quite, you know, which is quite amazing. And, you know, you can see it in all sorts of different settings and stuff. You know, shuls have it sometimes. I mean, some shuls have set chazan, right? But some shuls, you know, like come Shabbos, you just send, you know, people like to go over and they lead the services. It's interesting to watch. And some, with those shuls that do it, and sometimes someone goes over to do it and rushes to do it. And you see, like, they're completely, I mean, this is not a bad thing. It's not a tragedy. It doesn't hurt anyone else. But just it always ceases to amaze me how someone can be like almost completely tone deaf and they actually think they're amazing. I mean, it's like incredible. But that's like a harmless self. I mean, it's an inconvenience for the people for a couple of hours and you put up with it and you go home. But and you don't ask the guy again. But it's just an interesting thing how someone actually can be incredibly like unaware of themselves, right? And unfortunately, it happens with personalities also. People will tell you that they're a kind person, they're a nice person, they're a sensitive person, they're just totally unaware of their own strengths or weaknesses. And humility is about being honest and not being afraid to highlight our own weaknesses and not being afraid to know our place, to have the healthy confidence, to have the healthy ambition, as we've talked about so many times, but just to be aware of self, and then to learn, which leads then to learn from others, to embrace others, to experience, to get what others can give to the equation, where others can contribute, where we can't. And we do the same, right? And to come to the, on a very, very basic level, to come to that realization that actually we need each other because we're not perfect. None of us are perfect. So we actually need each other. We complement each other. We support each other. We inspire each other. We give to each other. And we take from each other. Not in a negative way, but we get supported by each other. And that's what connection is all about. But the core of that is humility. I can't do this on my own. I cannot run the world on my own because I'm just not perfect, right? So that's what humility is. But it comes, they point out, and correctly so, it comes from a bit of honesty. It comes from accuracy and honesty about oneself. You know, they say something very powerful. Like, how do you be, again, it's like, this is what I was saying before about working symptomatically and sort of behaviorally, right? So how do you practice humility? Right, you know, you're either humble or you're not, right? You know, they tell a little story in the shtetl about, you know, you have to know what real humility means, right? They say before Rosh Hashanah, once, I don't know, a rabbi got up, and he was like berating himself. And he was saying, I'm nothing, I'm this, I'm that, because, you know, false humility is also not such a good thing. Right, so he was saying, I'm nothing, I'm not so knowledgeable, I'm not this, I'm not that. And he was like being very humble. So the chazan got up and he also did the same thing. And then some little simple yid at the end of the shul, so you know, so he thought that's like kind of, you know, group therapy here. So he decided he'll do the same thing. He gets up and he says, you know, I'm nothing, I'm garnish, I'm this. So the chazan looks at him and says, look who thinks he's humble. Right? as if it was a privilege to be humble, right? So you know, but it's about, but how do we practice humility? How do we get there? How do we sort of inculcate or internalize the concept of humility? And what they say something very nice in their writings. They say, the key to practicing personal change is to set a goal, right? So in other words, there's a general goal, like, you know, I'd like to put others first, or I'd like to experience other people without thinking always about myself. But then they say you have to put in action steps. So for example, you know, I'll volunteer for 2 hours a week, even though it's hard for me. I'll volunteer to do kindness 2 hours a week. Or I will not interrupt others, you know, at least from 2 to 3:30 in the afternoon, at least. You know, I mean, like, you know, some of us have a habit of always interrupting other people. It's unkind. It's disrespectful. Make a conscious effort. Try, even for an hour, 2 hours, right? I will, you know, limit things that I don't need. I won't just go on shopping sprees all the time just to buy. I'll limit that kind of thing. To set our own personal goals. Now, what are they? They're personal goals that normally would express or manifest someone that's a bit more reserved, a bit more refined, a bit more humble. But it can work the other way around. We can actually practice these things and then become more like that. So that's that lesson. It's a powerful thing, I think, about practicing humility. In other words, practicing things, putting actions in place that we do or we don't do, which express humility, which is key to preventing self-indulgence, self-expression, self-absorption, and narcissistic behavior, right? You know, and also practicing not doing the famous story with Hillel in the Talmud, where a very famous story where a non-Jew came to Shammai, first, the contemporary of Hillel, and he said he wants to convert, but he wants to learn the entire Torah on one foot. So Shammai wasn't that pleased, so he said, no, sorry, can't do that. So he went to Hillel, and Hillel was, Shammai was a very great tzaddik as well, but Hillel was excelled in patience and tolerance and so on and so forth. So he told him, he said, oh, you want to learn Torah on one foot? Okay, no problem. So he puts up his foot, so he says, what you don't like done to yourself, don't do to others. That's the entire Torah, and the rest is commentary. Now, that itself is an interesting story, and needs depth, needs explanation, because obviously that process would include not only things between man and man, it would include things between man and God. But essentially, actually, Hillel was not only... because what did Hillel actually mean? That's the entire Torah, and the rest is commentary. It might be the basis of a part of Torah. I mean, we know Torah is divided into two. Mitzvot between what we call man and man, which means like kindness, empathy, helping other people, not stealing, not taking revenge, not hating, not being jealous, all that kind of stuff, right? True. So what you don't like done to yourself, don't do to others is certainly the basis of all of that. But how's it the basis of, lighting Shabbos candles? How's it the basis of putting up a mezuzah? And yet Hillel said, that's the basis of everything, right? That's the basis of everything, and the rest is commentary. What do you mean by that? And essentially, the commentaries explain, yes, actually it's the basis of the entire Torah. Because it's about making space for other people. It's about not being completely wrapped in ourselves. And as we've said previously in this series even, that when you make space for other people, then you're able to make space for God as well. So it's about focusing on our soul, not focusing on our body so much, or not focusing on the animal part of us, but more focusing on the godly part of us, right? So he said, yeah, that actually is the thing. Because if you can practice that, if you can be humble, it works both ways. It works between man and man, and between man and God. It's actually together. Because we learn not just to do what we want, we learn to make space for other people and ultimately for a higher purpose as well. Okay. So that's just the idea of practicing humility. But we talked about the concept of empathy also being sensitive to others. In other words, noticing others. I want to tell you a powerful story. Just as I was preparing this, it came to mind again. I might have told you this a number of years ago. It's just about like sometimes, you know, being almost creative and thinking ahead, thinking what would that person feel, what would that person do, right? So, after the war, people were very displaced, as you know, but there was a community of refugees, of survivors that landed up back in Romania. And it was very hard, they didn't have all the Jewish resources that they needed, and so on and so forth. And among the survivors in Romania, there were two Hasidic rebbes. One was the Skulene Rebbe, and the other one was the Vizhnitsa Rebbe, if that means anything. It's just the towns in Europe. Skulene Rebbe, by the way, later came to America. He was an amazing, amazing person. His just love for his fellow Jew was just incredible. That was his whole life, just doing for others, helping others, supporting others. Anyway, so it was coming up to Pesach, and there was no matzah. Right? There was no matzah. So tremendous difficulty, the Skulene Rebbe managed to arrange a run of matzah baking, but very limited. See, let it be known in the community that a few days before Pesach, the matzah will be ready. But it has to be limited, and everyone should just come and take three matzahs. No more than three matzahs. The idea was, it won't be for the whole Pesach. The whole Pesach will eat fish and potatoes or whatever. But it will just be for the Seder. Each person will be able to have a piece of matzah and fulfill the mitzvah, right? Okay. Fine, so it worked. They actually did this run. It was very hard to get even the stuff they did get. And it was going to run out fairly quickly, and he allowed every family, representative of every family, to get three matzahs. Suddenly, a couple of days before Pesach, there's a knock at the door. It's the son of the Vizhnitsa Rebbe. He said, my father sent me to get the matzahs, but he told me, gave me a message, that he needs six matzahs. Not three, he must have six matzahs. Which seemed at the time a little bit selfish, like it seems like weird. It's kind of expensive, you can't, it's a problem. He said only three, no one can be an exception. There has to be three matzahs per person, right? He goes back, tells his father says, no, go back and tell him, I have to have six matzahs. Okay, he goes back and says, I'm sorry, my father, the vision of Rebbe, he was a great person. Didn't have a choice. He gave him six matzahs. Fine. Keeps giving out the matzahs and so on. 5 minutes before Yontif comes in, the next day, just as everyone's about to light the candles and Pesach's about to begin, there's a knock at the door again. Same son of the vision of Rebbe. Coming, carrying three matzahs. He said, why are you coming to give back now the three matzahs? He said, no, I'm coming to give you the three matzahs. My father said that when you started this thing that you're going to give out three matzahs to every family, he was sure that you're going to give out three matzahs to every family till everything's finished and you're not going to leave three matzahs for yourself. That's why he insisted on getting six matzahs so that he would know just before Yom Tov he'd be able to bring the matzahs to you and bring you the three matzahs. And that's exactly what happened. It was true. The Vilna Rebbe knew that. He knew his customers. And he knew that because the school Rebbe gave it out until the last person came to us and he didn't have anything for himself. So it's a story of, and I mean, matzahs obviously is important to everyone, but you can imagine how important it was to these individuals, right? So it's a story of tremendous selflessness on the school Rebbe's part, but a tremendous sensitivity on part of the vision Rebbe, right? That he, like, how did he figure that out? So, in other words, everyone was coming to get their matzahs and they were taking care of themselves, which was not a bad taking care of themselves. It was an excellent taking care of themselves. They were coming. Imagine Jews broken after the war, still worrying about the mitzvah of eating matzah and the enthusiasm and the passion. I mean, that's in itself an incredible thing. The fact that there was any passion after the war still to be connected to Torah and mitzvahs is an unbelievable testament to the ingrained faith of the Jewish people. So that was an amazing thing. But the vision Rebbe went a step further. That's that noticing, that understanding, what's going to happen to the other person. Right, thinking, hold on a second, I know what's going on. Yeah, he's giving out the matzah. I know what's going to happen. He's going to give out everything. He's not going to be left for himself, so I need to take care of him. And that's why he asked for six, so he can take back three. Part of empathy is exactly this, and that's why I've quoted the study a number of times that today there's a decline in empathy, because people don't notice each other, because we're too buried in our devices, we're too buried in our technology, our mind is too all over the place. That's why, interestingly enough, maybe we'll talk about it more next week, they connect mindful living and mindfulness with empathy. What's the connection? The connection is because when you become more mindful, you actually start to notice. You actually become aware. We're not aware. We're not an aware society anymore. We're very much in our own world a little bit, right? I'm not saying everyone. I'm just saying it's a problem, right? So that awareness, that sensitivity to notice what someone else is going through, to notice that kid on the bus, to notice that person's not here, to notice that person's a little bit off today, right? Yeah.
I think that there is also, though, when children have not been noticed, they develop empathy and they notice a lot, but if they continue not to be noticed, that can also transform
absolutely
into manipulation and narcissism.
Absolutely. It's like every, very, very often, challenges that children go through in an overextended amount of time,
yeah,
they become the perpetrators of later,
right,
in lots of different areas.
But they have empathy, which seemingly is in contrast to this form of narcissism. But they use the empathy to
that's what you mean. Yeah, okay, so that's a different kind of empathy. That's not real empathy, right? When you use anything to manipulate someone else, that's not empathy.
That's what I didn't hear.
That's not empathy. I mean, that seems like empathy. It might be for different. I mean, anything can be used for the bad, but generally empathy is a very good thing, right?
Yes.
Always noticing someone else, but then using it as a manipulation is not a good thing.
Yes. No.
It needs to be developed. That's why we need to teach empathy. We need to teach what that means. But it comes also from being valued as well.
Right.
You're more able to value people in a good way.
Right.
Yeah. So then there's another concept, which I mentioned in the beginning, right? And that's the idea of not only noticing someone else, not only being sensitive to someone else, but celebrating someone else. And I want to share with you an insight that I came across. My wife actually shared it with me because she was giving a shiur around Shavuot time, which then I used in a men's shiur. It was a good resource. And I'm using it now as well. So The reason why I was connected to Yontif and last week's parasha is the mitzvah of the Kohanim. So someone who's a Kohen has a mitzvah to bless the people, right? You've ever seen in Shul, the Kohanim bless the blessed. Where does it come from? It comes from last week's parasha, actually, where God says to Moses, tell Aharon, his brother, who was the Kohen, and that he should speak to his children and their descendants, that this will be a mitzvah of the Kohanim, that they have to bless other people. In Israel, by the way, it's done every day. Every morning in Shul, the Kohanim Duchim, as they call it, right? It's done much quicker than we do it today. In Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora, in the Sephardic community, it's also done every single day. It's actually quite cool. When we first started Bina, I was a part-time rabbi in a Sephardi synagogue here. I called myself a Sephardi in training. But it was very nice. I used to daven every morning. Part of that thing was in the middle of the repetition of that. I know, but still, I love their traditions. I learned so much. It was one of the best times I had in my life. But they used to do Birkat Kohanim. They used to do the Kohen blessing every single morning, which was very cool. Okay, in Chutz La'aretz, in the diaspora today, we only do it on the Chagim. Okay. Now, when the Kohanim stand up there by the Ark and they bless the people, they say a special blessing. And the blessing goes that they bless God for commanding him with this mitzvah. But they say that God commanded us b'kedushato shel Aharon, with the holiness of Aharon. Aharon was the first Kohen, right? Moses' brother. Why do they emphasize, what does that mean, he commanded us with the holiness of Aharon? What does that mean? So what it means is, we know that on a very simple level, the concept of giving blessing, the Talmud tells us that there's no greater vehicle for blessing, vessel for blessing. If you want blessing to rest in your life, you want blessing to come into your life or your family or your community, the best way, the Talmud says, is shalom, through peace. Right? When people are peaceful, they don't fight with each other, when they're not divided, that brings down godly blessing. That's what we say, right? Now, we also know that Aharon, right, Aharon, the Kohen, he was known, he was renowned as Ohev Shalom Varadev Shalom. He was a person, that was his mission in life. He loved peace and pursued peace. It says about Aharon that he would go around, he would make peace between husband and wife, between friends that were fighting, between community. That was his thing, right? Okay. So therefore, it makes sense that the descendants of Aharon, you know, in order to bless someone else, you need that ingredient. So therefore, they hopefully inherited the gene, not always, but they inherited the gene of Shalom, and therefore they have the power to impart that godly blessing to the people. Okay. That's on a simple level, but it goes a lot deeper than that. And there's a whole Kabbalistic idea that goes like this. That there's a midrash that says that midrashim are often written in a very cryptic way, so you have to decode them a little bit. And then use the commentaries to decode them, right? So the midrash says there's a verse in Tanakh where the Jewish people turned to God and say, Mi yitencha ka'achli, you should be like my brother. We want God to be close to us, like a brother to a brother, right? So the Midrash says, what do the Jewish people mean? Brother, what kind of brother? I mean, we have a history in the Torah, if you look, where things weren't so good between brothers. And that's obviously not what we're asking God to be. And the Midrash goes and lists the whole thing. One of the first incidences of the creation of the world was a fight between two brothers. Cain and Abel, right? Cain was the older brother. He couldn't tolerate Hevel, because Hevel brought a sacrifice, and he brought a good sacrifice, and God accepted. He didn't get his. He was jealous of him. Boom, the first murder, the first jealousy, the first conflict. Didn't take long after the world was created, and boom, done. He killed his brother. Oh. Oh. Obviously, that's not what we mean, right? Who do we mean, said the Medrash? Yitzchak and Ishmael. Right? Yitzchak and Ishmael, I mean, up until today, we're not the greatest of friends, right? Yeah, Abraham had two sons. One's from Hagar, Ishmael, the father of the Arabs. The Arabs. And Yitzchak. Well, Yitzchak and Ishmael. Ishmael was persecuting Yitzchak. to the point that actually Sarah and Abraham had to send him away. Later on, it says he came back. He reconnected. But that's not the kind of brothers. Who are we talking about? Says the Medrash. Esav and Yaakov. Right? Esav was trying to kill Yaakov. Yosef and the brothers, okay, it wasn't as bad, but they weren't that good either. They sent him to Egypt, right? So who are we talking about, says the Medrash, right? It says the Medrash, we're talking about Aaron and Moshe. They were the best brothers. Why? Let's go back a second. So the Kabbalists explain, why does the Medrash list all these brothers? I'm just sharing with you a nice idea anyway, but just to complete the concept. So what happened was that when the world was created, it was a fight between an older brother and a younger brother. It was an expression of the godly design of human being gone wrong, that the intolerance to be able to not be able to celebrate another person, particularly someone who's younger than you, a younger sibling, and that went horribly wrong, and Cain killed Hevel. When Yishmael and Esav came along, say the Kabbalists, they were actually a reincarnation of Cain and Hevel. That's what it says. Esav was the incarnation of Cain, Yishmael was a reincarnation of Cain, Yitzchak was a reincarnation of Hevel, and there was an opportunity to fix what went wrong, and it didn't happen. It didn't happen again, with same thing with Esav and Yaakov, it also didn't happen, right? There's a whole explanation with the brothers and Yosef, I'll go through that now. When did it happen? It happened with Aaron and Moshe. What happened? And if you think about an amazing thing, the Jews were in Egypt. They were in under slavery, they were oppressed, they were working for a long time. Moses is born, but Moses is born, he's 3 years younger than Aaron. Right? Moses doesn't grow up among the community of Jewish people, you know the biblical story. He was found in the river when he was a little child by the daughter of Pharaoh, and he's actually raised in Pharaoh's palace. Then the Pasuk says, when he grew up, became an adult, he went out and he connected with his brethren. That was the first time you actually connected with the Jewish community at the time. And he saw their slavery and he felt really bad for them. And then what happened was, he witnessed another biblical story. He witnessed an Egyptian beating up a Jew, and he ended up killing the Egyptian to protect the Jew. And then it got out. He thought no one was looking. Got out Pharaoh. Pharaoh wanted to arrest him and capture him. Miraculously, he escaped, and he escaped to, the Midrash says, to Africa and then to Midian, where he got married, the daughter of Yitro. But he was absent for about 60 years. He ran away. He wasn't there. Sorry?
60 years.
Yes, he was absolutely, yeah. When he came back, when he took the Jews out of Egypt, he was 80. Yeah, Moses was 80. He passed away, and then he took the Jews in the desert for 40 years. He passed away when he was 120. That's where the expression comes, bis 120. The expression of until 120 comes from Moses. Because Moses was the 120, right? 80. He was 80 when he became the leader of the Jewish people. Now,
when God spoke
with the burning bush, he was 80. Or just before 80. He was 80, he took the Jews out of Egypt, but he was maybe 79 or something like that. Right? Okay.
If you're living to
120, 80 is the crown of your life. Okay. Be it as it may. Right? But the reason I'm going to this detail is I want you to understand. I want to paint you a picture of what was going on in these 60 years, right? So in these 60 years, the Jews were enslaved, they were persecuted, they were oppressed. And who was the inspiration, if they had any? Who was it? It was Aaron. We don't have to talk about that, because that part of the story is not so in detail. It was Moses' brother, Aaron, who was 3 years older than him. Then suddenly, towards this whole end of the thing, so he's taking care of the flock of his father-in-law, and he lands up in the desert. And there's a burning bush, the famous story of the burning bush. And he sees some miraculous thing, he goes close, and God's voice calls out to him, and he stands at the burning bush and communicates with God. And God tells him, you've got to go back to Egypt and take the Jewish people out of Egypt, you need to be the leader. And he argues with God. In fact, according to the Medrash, he argued with God for 7 days. So it was a big debate, until God got angry with him. Right? He didn't want to do it. Moses was a very humble person. He had a speech impediment at that time. Who's going to help me? How am I going to do it? I'm not able to do it. I'm not able to face the Jewish people. I'm not able to face Pharaoh. It's like, not me. And then he says, I've got a brother. Correctly so. He says, I've got a brother. He's qualified. And don't forget, the brother was 3 years older than him, right? And Moses must have known, if you think about it, that who's been doing this till now? I mean, there hasn't been much Jewish leadership because they've been slaves to Pharaoh. But if anyone was a go-to person for the Jewish people at that time, it must have been Aaron. His father was a very famous leader, Amram, and then must have been passed to him, which is exactly what happened. His father was a famous...
When he came back,
his father wasn't alive anymore.
Who was Pharaoh? His brother?
No, who was the Pharaoh? I don't know who the Pharaoh at that time was, but it was...
When Moses went to talk to Pharaoh, let my people go.
Yeah.
So his father obviously died.
Whose father?
His stepfather. He's the guy that raised...
Oh, yeah, yeah. It wasn't the same Pharaoh. No, it wasn't the same Pharaoh. No.
He didn't.
No, it wasn't the same. They were all called Pharaohs in those days. All Egyptian leaders were called Pharaohs, yeah. Right? So God says to him, no, you don't understand who Aaron is. You don't understand who Aaron is. He says, you don't have to worry about Aaron. First of all, he's going to help you. And then he says a very famous verse. And God was sort of projecting what's going to happen because he knew Aaron. And this is exactly what happened. That he said, you will go to Egypt and Aaron will come and welcome you. And he said three words. God said to Moses three words, which is what actually happened. And he said, V'ra'acha, he will see you. V'samach belibo, is going to rejoice in his heart. He's not going to tolerate that you became the leader, which is also a level. He's going to rejoice. He's going to celebrate that you're the leader. That's a level. He's going to celebrate it. Because it's not about him. We're not all at this level, but it's kind of hard sometimes, right? You know, the Talmud says, "Bakol adam mitkaneh." A person is naturally jealous of every single human being, except for his child and his student, right? Because I guess people see that as an extension of themselves. That's not such a problem, but right? But so you know, if the student does better than them or the child does better than them, that's fine. But otherwise, you know, us human beings we're a bit territorial, right? Just naturally human being. I mean, that's something you're supposed to work on. Aaron was also the reincarnation of Cain, and when he did that, he fixed the neshama, it says, the Kabbalists say he fixed the soul of Aaron, and he got part of the soul of Hevel, which was also part of Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu was also the reincarnation of Hevel, that's what the Kabbalists tell us, and that's when this whole thing got fixed. But who was it? It was Aaron. Aaron wasn't just an Ohev Shalom, he wasn't only a person that loved peace and pursued peace. Right? He wasn't only kind to other people. He wasn't only sensitive to other people, he celebrated other people. In Yiddish, they call it fargin. I think in Hebrew also there's a word, lefargen, no? Lefargen, is it? I think in Hebrew they use it as well. It means to like I'm okay for you to have it, I celebrate for you to have it, I'm happy for you. Even if it's in my own context. Moses was taking over Aaron's job, essentially, and he was doing the same thing Aaron could have done. But he was happy for him. Why was he happy for him? Because he wasn't a Nebuch. Aaron was a very strong person, a very great person, but he was humble. And to him, it was about the Jewish people needed to be led out of Egypt. And if God wanted Moses to do it, he was fine with that. Not only was fine with that, he celebrated that. Right? And that's part of a greater depth of empathy. Not just to have compassion for other people, tolerate other people, be sensitive to other people, actually celebrate other people. Value them, celebrate them, even when it's a little bit in conflict with your own thing, right? I'll tell you an amazing story that the Talmud tells us. And I've learned this many times, but every time I learn, I always think, wow. And I'm only comforted by the fact that the, you know, us human beings, even we do good things, even we humble, but we like a bit of credit, you know? It's like, so there's a story in the Talmud about a great sage called Rabbi Avahu. Now, the Talmud tells it as an exceptional practice, so I'm comfortable with that because I'm not sure every human being can actually reach this, but it's a nice aspirational concept. So in times of the Talmud, when you had a Rosh Hashiva, you had a big Torah teacher, right? The way it used to work, often when they were older, they used to sit on a dais, I guess, and give the shiur, right? But it wasn't done like we do nowadays. It was actually, they would have what's called an interpreter, a mitargem. Not interpret in different language, but someone who knew how to talk and project a voice and to explain things. And the way it used to work, the mitargem would like bow down and he would listen to the teacher would say a few sentences and he would take those sentences and then expound on them and teach the crowd, right? That's how it was done. So Rabbi Avo had a mitargem, he had his interpreter. And the Talmud says the two wives met one day. Rabbi Avo's wife was the interpreter's wife. And the interpreter's wife said to Rabbi Avo's wife, she said to him, you really think that my husband needs to listen to Rabbi Avo to know what to say to the crowd? He just bows down for respect, but what he says is his own stuff. It's not, he's really giving the shir. Okay. So Mrs. Rabbi Avo was not impressed. That's what the Talmud says, right? It's my husband, right? So she goes over and she tells Rabbi Avo this. This is the Talmud says. She says, Rabbi Avo, are you not going to do something about this? And he said to her like this, it's unbelievable. He turned around and he said the following words. He says, what do I care if it's from me or from him, as long as God's name is praised? What he meant to say, the shiur was given, I heard it, he said good stuff, fine, I don't care. That's pretty good, that's pretty, right? Okay, that's a kind of very deep level of this concept. But like I've told you, like every time we Every time, I mean, it's one thing to make space for others, but it's one thing, like, you know, to give a share, so someone else take the credit. Like, but okay, so it's, but we tell these extreme stories because they have an aspirational concept to them. It's the idea we learn from them about celebrating others' success, celebrating others' people, lifting up others. It's all part of the same thing we're talking about. It's about not being trapped in ourselves. It's about expanding and trying to make room, but real room, celebration room sometimes for other people as well. I want to just end off with one concept of something they talk about in their book, and it's actually very in line with the Jewish idea, and I want to just sort of talk about this. Because one of the things they talk about, one of the ways we reach this, one of the ways we sort of internalize this idea, is understanding the connection between us, right? They tell an interesting experiment. There was a research study, an experiment they once did. Where is it? One second. Yeah. So they had participants in the study, a study, and they asked people to participate in the study. And they had someone insult them, really, really insult them. And they told them that if they get insulted, they had the opportunity to retaliate, like by making a huge blasting noise, I don't know, to really give it to the guy, right? And like other studies, what they saw, because they obviously did a study on each individual afterwards, the people who were insulted, and saw, and you know, they could tell who was more narcissistic than others, and the narcissists among them obviously were much more aggressive in their retaliation, right? Which is not surprising. But then the new experiment added a twist. What did they do? Half the participants were told that the other person was similar to them, like they shared a birthday with them, or they had some sort of rare fingerprint or something that they both shared, or something like that, right? And when they felt there's something in common, they were much less aggressive. Why? Because when you feel that someone's like you, you kind of, even a narcissist will sort of tone down the thing. What's the idea? So one of the things they talk about in their book is a difficult concept to get our head around, because they're very against this thing of making people special and unique, right? We're not special, unique, we're all one. But it's not entirely true, because we are all unique. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here, right? We all have, like we've mentioned many times, we all think differently, we all look differently, we all have a different personality, and for a good reason, because we all have a different contribution to make to the world and to the greater good. So I think the way it works is like this. The way we make room for others, knowing that we are different, actually, but being different doesn't make us special. Why? Because we come from the same essence. So I'm reminded about something that is in this coming week's weekly parsha. Right? In this coming week's weekly parsha, there's a mitzvah to kindle the menorah every day in the temple. Right? When they built the temple, they built the Mishkan, there was the golden menorah. How was the golden menorah built and designed? It was a very, very complicated design. So to the extent that Moshe Rabbeinu, we are told in the Midrash, he couldn't get his head around. He couldn't even do it. It was hard. God had to help him because it was very tricky. Because the menorah was a beautiful golden menorah. It had seven branches and had a lot of decoration on it in terms of golden flowers and golden cups and all kinds of things. It was a very intricate design in seven branches. But the halacha was, the mitzvah was, that it had to be made from one solid piece of gold. In other words, you couldn't do this design by welding on the cup, the flower, the branches. You had to make it all from one piece of gold, which was incredibly difficult to do. So the question is, what was the point of that, right? What was the point of the design? So Kabbalah tells us that the seven branches, you know, the soul of a person is compared to a candle, right? And therefore we are taught that the seven branches of the menorah are actually like seven different types of souls, seven different personality types of souls, right? And the idea of the Kohen kindling in the menorah every day was the spiritual idea of infusing each soul with strength, igniting the soul of different people. Why seven souls? Because we know we have seven midot. We have seven emotions, which we've talked about many times, which give rise to a personality. And therefore, each have a different dominant one. And therefore, we have seven general different types of personalities in the world, which result in seven different types of souls. Which is good, because that's the idea. We're supposed to be different. We're not all the same. We have different emphasis, you know. Certain people, their focus in life is studying. Other people, focus is kindness. Whatever the case is, right? We all do. We all commit it to the same principles, but we channel them differently because we're different people, and that's the way it's supposed to be. But, says God, the way you got to design this menorah is one piece of gold. Because the personality of each soul is different. The expression of each soul is different, but at the core, they're one. At the core, they're the same. Right? And I think it's a good model of how to balance the concept of uniqueness and difference, and yet connection and making space for other people and relationships with others. We respect other people, we sensitive to other people, we celebrate other people, because no one's better than me, and I'm not better than anyone else, because we're actually all one. One but unique. We're one menorah, but we're seven branches. And that's good. If the seven branches are seven branches, and distinctly seven branches, because we're all so different, but we come and we understand that at the core, we're all made in the image of God, at the core, we're all one, at the core, we all come from the same source, then that makes it easier to breed that level of empathy and to make room and make space for another people, even to the point of celebrating another person. So we'll leave it there now. Just want to remind everyone, we're getting towards the end of our raffle. It's doing well. Those who haven't yet participated or would like to participate more, please see the office. Again, next week we're going to talk about more steps we can take and more actions, more tools to deal with self-centeredness and to make room for others and to move away from narcissistic behavior or self-centered behavior. And just a reminder that in 2 weeks' time, as I said at the beginning, we'll have a one-off thing called We Are All Leaders. It's the 3rd of Tammuz. We'll hopefully have a bit of a refreshments as well. So come along, share with your friends, and then we'll take a break for the term. Have a wonderful day. Wow.